Well, Duty Here Nancy was born, and then I was in the December of 1959. In February, Craig had never started to talk. Gosh, we run him all over the country. We took him down to Children's Hospital to see why he didn't talk. And they said, oh, he hadn't got anything to say. And he went on, they didn't know. Only along that spring, in 1960, in May of 19, in the last of May or somewhere, they put me on high council. Last Sunday of May of 1960, I was sustained a member of the high council of Benson State. And I sat on that high council with Dr. Scablin, and along that summer, all at once, in the clear blue sky, he sold his practice to Dr. D. Gibbons and moved to Logan. We took all these kids up to Dr. Gibbons for some reason. General run of the mill, I guess. We said to Dr. Gibbons, why don't that kid talk? He's old enough, he ought to be saying something. And he just wandered around and never said a word. He went over and took a hold of Craig's hair. He said, well, for one thing, he's short of thyroid. So they start feeding him thyroid. He gets prescription, told us how to start. And in a few months, Craig started to talk. And I was grateful for that. And we come around here to the time when, in February of 1961, Gary was born. You and I, here in about 7 years, we'd had six kids. This made 10 of them. You know? Your mother just couldn't get over it. Now, when I get through with this speech, she may want to correct it, and that's all right. But she just couldn't get over it. She'd recovered when other kids were born, but this seemed to be the end of the road. I believe it was July. I think the 4th of July was on a Tuesday. And we had Monday off and was going to work the following Saturday. And so I was home, but Sunday night, I think it was a Sunday night, long, and I guess about 3 o'clock Monday morning, your mother woke me and said, help me up, I can't breathe. I jumped up and lifted her up, and she was just screaming with chest pains. Oh, my land, and I run into the phone, and she said, don't call a doctor, wait till morning. I didn't dare wait till morning. Dr. Gibbons answered the phone and said, this is Dr. Gibbons. And I said, doctor, this is Lindsay Rawlins. I'm afraid my wife's having a heart attack. And I heard the phone drop. And in a matter of minutes, he came in this front door. He had a pair of sandals on, his pants on, his shirt in one hand, and his satchel in the other one. By then I had moved Julie into the front room on the couch, and she was sitting there gasping for breath. Now here she comes in the house. She might not approve this story. As Dr. Gibbons came in the house, he ran over to her and checked her heart. And then got something out of his case and gave her a shot in the arm. Then sat there and kept track of her heartbeat. And he shook his head and he said, "I cheer in the middle of the night and I'm wide awake." "That's no heart attack. I'm convinced it's a gallstone attack. That shot I gave her should relieve it." And he stayed with her till she felt better and was able to sleep, maybe get some rest. And he said, "Why don't you call up my secretary in the morning and come on in?" Now let's see how this... So the next day, as soon as the office was open, I called up and made an appointment. And we went up to see him. Here it was, the 3rd of July, 1961. I sat out in the waiting room out there, and while he went in, she went in to be examined. Pretty soon out the door she come with tears in her eyes and right on past me and out into the car. And as she went by, I looked at her and I wondered, now what? And as I looked back, the doctor was standing in the door and he said, "I'd like to talk to you." I would like to say of Dr. Gibbons, he is our own kind of a boy, our own kind of a doctor. He was well trained, he'd been on a mission, so he knew the church side of it. Many doctors didn't. He understood the gospel more deeply than if he hadn't have been on a mission. And he said, "Lynn, I told your wife that the only way I knew to keep her alive, if she ever had another baby, it would kill her. You would lose her. You'll lose her, Lynn, if she has one more baby, either in a mental breakdown, or you could lose her actually in death. But one way or the other, your biggest chance is you're going to lose her if you continue. Now, the only thing I know to stop a mental breakdown, and she's real close, is a hysterectomy." And she just told me she wouldn't do it. And so, that's why she left in a huff. And I said, "Well," I went over to the calendar and I said, this is Monday, I believe, and if you'll schedule me a week from this coming Friday, schedule her for operation. That gives me 2 weeks to convince her and to be there. All right, he said, "Now that..." In order to comply with the state law, you will have to have 2 other doctors confirm this. And I said, "Well, who do you want to help you?" He said, "If Dr. Cragen was here, I could use him. But Dr. Cragen is in South America on a tour." I said, "I'd like Dr. Scablin." He said, "I'd like to have Dr. Scablin give the anesthetic." He said, "There's 2 other doctors. I would prefer Dr. Willis Hayward to be the next one." And I said, "Oh, dear. Only objection I've got to Dr. Hayward is that he's a member of the Budge Clinic." And he laughed and said, "I know what you're thinking. Dr. Willis Hayward has had some problems. He lost his wife. Somebody stole his wife. But he went on a mission as a young man. He's had some trouble since. I don't think he's active in the church now. But he's the kind of the best help I can find along this line." And I said, well, with you there and with Dr. Scablin there, we'll accept Dr. Hayward. I said, would it be better that you set up the appointments? And he said, yes, it would be. So then I went out and got in the car and brought your mother home. And she calmed down a little bit. We sat down here and visited. Here was a tough deal. It was hard for her to understand that if there's a part of the body offend thee, you take it out. To leave those parts in her body was offensive to all the rest. Dr. Gibbons also told me that over the nation, over the world, they had lost many women at this stage of the game. But you needed to take out those parts after a family of six, if you've had your family, any time after six, to avoid cancer, which has cost the world a lot of mothers, he told me. And he said, we have the statistics to prove that in medical school. And so, as I started discussing this with Julia, it was clear to my mind that that was the thing to do. Let's hear this back. I said, now, Julia, you've got to tell your mother and your dad. And she said, no, I'm not going to. And I said, now, you're going to have to tell them, or I will. Now, you can think it over. And there's one other person we ought to talk to. I said, I guess we ought to go to Bishop, but he'd send us to the stake president anyway. And let's just bypass the one, and I'm serving on the High Council for President Holt. And let's go talk to him. And she said, no, let's not us go talk to him. Let's you go talk to him. All I do is cry, and I don't want to do that in front of him. I said, all right, I'll call up President Holt, so I'll call him up. I said, if you've got time, I'd like to come visit with you. And he said, come on down. So I got down there and sat down in his front room, and he said, what can I do for you? And I said, well, this is the tougher part of your ministry. And I told him where we'd been, and I told him of the escapade the night before. We'd been to the doctor. And this was Dr. Gibbons' recommendation. That she go through with this operation. Of course, that ends the family. And the thing that bothered her, and so forth, there was things bothering her about the fact that maybe she hadn't raised all her children. Didn't have them all. And President Holt sat there and looked at me, and he said, my mind is just as clear as it's ever been. And I'm just as sure of what I tell you is the truth. I'll defend your wife, I'll defend Julia in any court in this world or in the world to come. That she has fulfilled her job in bearing children. But she hasn't fulfilled her job in raising children. And so she should do all she could do to maintain life, to raise those 10 kids. Now, she'll not come under condemnation in going this route. But if she don't do everything she can do to maintain life, to raise the kids she's got, there's a possibility of some condemnation on that side. He said, would she like to talk to me? And I said, well, she's afraid she'd break down and cry, and she don't really want to do that in front of you. And he said, well, I wouldn't want to embarrass her. She said she'd believe it if I told her what you said. So I went home and told her what President Holt had said. By then she decided to call her mother, and she had called her mother while I was talking to President Holt and told her what was coming off. She said, her mother said, well, your dad isn't here. When he gets back, I'll tell him and he'll call you. Now, her dad was in the stake presidency at that time, in the Zion Pork Stake. And so he said, when he called her back, Julia, I think the doctor's right. And if you'd like, I'd come up and give you a blessing. She said, I'd like that. And said, your mother can tend to kids while you're in the hospital. Well, that was a good gesture and a good offer. Now, I think Ray was 14 years old, Glenn 13, Native 11. And you other guys can count your ages on down from there. And Gary was 6 months, not quite. One February, and this was July. Nada had done a lot of tending of Gary at this stage of the game. She did real well. So, I went with your mother to see Dr. Scablin at the appointed hour, the appointed day. With the three of us in there, Dr. Scablin said, Lynn, I wanted to give you this speech a year ago, but something kept holding me back. And I said, well, he said, being on the High Council, I wasn't sure what the church stand was. And I said, you do the operations which are necessary to sustain it, to keep people alive. And I told him what President Holt told me, and he said I didn't know that was the stand. But Dr. Gibbons, having been a missionary, knew a little deeper about it than those who didn't. President Holt had been on a mission with Willis Hayward in Czechoslovakia years ago. And so we proceeded, and Dr. Scablin said, I don't need to examine you, Julia. I know what Dr. Gibbons is telling you is the truth, and I'll sign it to that effect. So then she went to Dr. Willis Hayward, who checked her over and confirmed that Dr. Gibbons' diagnosis was correct. So it was about the middle of July. When we went in for the operation, I had told my boss out to work what I was up again. I was going to need some sick leave. And he said, well, you've got plenty of days of sick leave. Just use it as you need to. The morning that we went in for the operation, Julia was in for the operation. Dr. Scablin came in to get her. She was in the room, and she said, I don't know why I'm going. I'm not going to have this done. "Oh, Julia," he said, "you'll be just fine." I hadn't really convinced her. Her dad hadn't really convinced her, neither had President Holt. She'd come along pretty well after the operation. But with her mother here doing her work, she wouldn't stay in bed. So I said to my mother-in-law, "Now, Mother, I appreciate your help with all my heart. But we're killing you off because this is more work than you can handle. And I can't keep Julie in bed with you here. Now, in no way do I want to offend you. And we won't do it as good. But between me and Ray and Glenn and Nada and on down, yeah, I'll ask each kid to do their part. We'll do it. And I'd take you down to Logan and put you on the bus and let you go home." She said, "By golly, I believe you're right." She accepted it very gracefully, and I appreciated that. So we called up and found out when she'd go home. They took her down, put her on the bus, and let her go home. Now, a lot of women around town used to show up here on appointed days and gather up all the dirty clothes we had and take them home and wash them and bring them back. And with that many kids, some of these women that only raised 2 or 3 kids didn't believe there was that many clothes. But there was. And for that next year, I would go on a high council visit at Sunday night to church. And I would leave Julia home in bed with Nancy and Gary in bed. Buyer, and I'd take the 8 kids and set them down in the audience, and I knew which kid could sit by which one, and get them lined up in the position of where they ought to be, and who could sit by who, and I'd go up on the stand to take my part up there. Now, that was a real hard year. For that first year, from July clear around till the next May, whenever I'd go to sleep, I went to sleep to the tune of her grumbling at me because I had talked her into that operation. And not once did I ever lash back. I had convinced myself that I guess that was my treatment and my burden to bear, that I would have to listen to that the rest of my life. But along the next May, I discovered that she wasn't grumbling at me, and I didn't know whether she had quit. I was working long hours out to work and half of the night here to get the crops in, keep farming going, keep things going, keep up. My golly, was trying to help her 10 kids, keep the place a little bit in order. I was just running every hour of the day it seemed like there was. And when I hit the bed, I was gone completely. So somewhere about the 1st of June, I said to her, "Julia, I don't remember you grumbling at me for the last month. Have you finally forgiven me for talking you into the operation? She sat down there and looked at me for a few minutes. She said, "This has been the most mixed up year I've ever known. I appreciate the fact that you've gone along with me. I've now got my thinking straight, and I'm all right. And I was grateful for that. Because in March of that year, we had to take out our gallbladder. The gallstones had to wait. And there she was just recovering from losing her gallbladder. And that was two operations in less than a year. And then she recovered pretty well for a while. And the next winter, she went back down to bed. And I was talking to Dr. Gibbons that winter about it. That was the winter of 1961 and, no, 62 and 63. And that winter, she spent most of the time in bed. And I talked to Dr. Gibbons about it. And he said, "Lynn, we're losing her. And I don't know why. And I thought I was losing her." So in desperation, and I'd gone over this many times. And I remembered back when I married her that I had promised her she could go. I'd send her some year and let her finish her school, her college. She had four quarters left. So it was along in March of 63, I guess. I said to her, "Julia, would you like to go back to school and finish up and teach school while we send these sons on missions and these kids on missions and through college?" So one day we got in the car and drove all around the valley, different places, to different schools. Decided the most likely job for her to get that she would like would be elementary education. So one morning she got up and went down to Logan and Utah State and checked out on all she had and what she'd done and talked to them. She was in home economics, and originally when she was going to school before at this time, but they wanted to start her over as a sophomore, make her go through all that rigmarole again, and she didn't want to do that. So she went to the education and talked to them about elementary education. They accepted all she had and figured out so that if she took 6 hours spring quarter, then she'd take full load summer and all the next year. That then in June in 1964, she could have her certificate to teach and be graduated from college. And so So she registered for 6 hours for spring quarter and started. She'd go from 4 o'clock to 6:30, I believe, every Tuesday and Thursday. And she'd been going to school about 6 weeks. And I met Dr. Gibbons on the street. He said, "Hey, what have you done to Julia?" He said, "I visited with Julia the other day. And you solved the problem. Now what have you done?" "I didn't do it. And I need to know what's happened." And so I told him the story that we'd come up with the idea of Julie going back to school and finishing. Dr. Gibbons said, "Well, you found the trick." Now, lots of times when women are as sick as she's been, then the thing you have to do is get them up, change their environment, change things around. Now, you probably never ever keep her home again. Go into school and teaching, so she's get up. She's got something to get up and go do that she's got to do. You've extended her life at least 10 years and maybe more. So adjust your affairs so that you can help her. You can work it out. Because I don't think you'll ever be able to keep her home again, full time. And he said, "We find this in the medical field many times." So, in order for her to go to school, she applied for a scholarship and got it. She applied for a little help and got it. She borrowed some money through one of the government agencies without interest, and then if she taught school, she only had to pay half of it back. And then I went up to Rex Plowman up to the bank and told him what we were going to do, and asked him if he'd go along with me. He said, "Yes." "Yes," he said, "from a banker's standpoint, this is one of the better investments you've made. We'll go along with you. How much money do you need?" And I said, "Well, I don't really know. I'll go just as far as I can go. Then I'll come borrow just as small amount as I can borrow, as I can get by with. Because I want to get through this and not be any worse off financially than necessary." He said, "All right, go ahead, I'll stay with you." And so that's the way we proceeded. And so that was quite a year. We went through spring quarter pretty well, and then when we went full time, she went full time when summer come. That meant that in the summertime, he had 10 kids running around here. Me gone to work. Ray and Glenn, Nada, kind of herding the clan. Whatever. And I guess that's some sight to watch all 10 of these kids run around here by themselves. So my brother Howard came over to see me one Saturday morning when I was milking the cows. Ray kind of agreed to do the milking and chore the farming. And Glenn did the herding of the kids. Nada kind of took over Gary. And anyway, Howard come to see me one morning on his milking the cows. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean? I'm milking the cows. What are you worrying about? What are you talking about?" "No," he said, "what have you done? Just turned your kids loose?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess. Why?" "Well," he said, "what's Julia doing?" And I said, "She's going to college." "Well," he said, "how crazy are you?" "Well, I guess maybe if you've prepared a speech for me, I guess maybe you might as well give it." So I stood there and listened to him while he gave me the speech. Wife going off to work, abandoning the kids. All kids go to hell. That was the basis of his speech. It seemed quite long and quite tedious and quite boring. I had sweat that out among my tears of trying to decide what to do. And I didn't go into details with him. And I thanked him for his advice and counsel. And I said, "You know, Howard, we had an uncle, Harvey M. Rollins, Jr., Clem's dad, who claimed that voluntary advice wasn't any good. And that's about what I think of your speech." And he turned around and left. And I don't know whether he felt any better or whether he didn't, but I've often thought about that. I never did have, in my wife going to work, the thought in mind of abandoning my kids. And I never have. I stayed on days most of that summer. Then when it got time to go to school, I've been trying to think here. I think I started working swing shift about the latter part of August. No, Julia didn't start school. She went summer, and then she got through about the middle of August. And she was home till about the 1st of October. And so when she started school, then I went on swing shift. And I worked swing all winter. I've made arrangements. We used to hold high council meetings, some of them Sunday morning, some of the Thursday night ones. Maybe that first year I didn't go swing all the time. Maybe that was it. Maybe it was the next year. But anyway, we got Elva Porter to help tend the kids. And we'd leave these three younger ones. And that wasn't too satisfactory. So the next year at least, and until Gary went to school there for several years. Till Gary got to where he was in school, I'd work swing shift. And that meant that I left here about 2 o'clock, and we'd have him, that we could put him somewhere. I think some of the other kids just older would scoot home to be with him, and then the older kids would get home, and then Julia would be home about 3 to 4 o'clock. And so, but that year going to school, I guess I must have stayed days most of that year, because I remember come home and we'd have supper. And then Julia would go to bed. And I'd keep the kids around here and get them through their lessons and get them all to bed, and then I'd go to bed. And I'd notice that the alarm clock would be set for 1 or 2 in the morning. I'd leave the furnace on and all stoked up, and she'd get up and in that kitchen table, she'd pull the big light down and there she'd study. The house was quiet and warm. Okay. Then she would, somewhere along the line, go to bed. She'd set the alarm for, I had to get up about 4:30, get the cows milked, get quiet around, so I could go to work. And she'd go to bed then, and she'd set the alarm and get up when it was necessary, get the kids off school and her off to school. And that was quite a thing. She was on the honor roll most of the winter. Come June of 1964, I hope that's the year, she graduated from college. Most of her family came up. I used to tell her that me and the kids would all be there in line and give 3 cheers as she walked down the road to get her diploma. And I remember the next Sunday was Fast Sunday, and I got up to bear my testimony. I was so grateful to have her through college that I broke down and just cried. Now, that's the first time I believe that people in this ward ever heard me bawl in giving a testimony. But I was so pleased to have this job done, and I was so proud of her. She done real well. She had a contract to teach first grade at Smithfield that fall. Well, gosh, we enjoyed that summer. She was home, and her health was pretty good, the best it had been in quite a few years. And just as we were getting ready to start school, on the way to work one morning, Vera was driving. Hugh Van Orden was in the back seat. Oh dear, there's another guy. I can't remember his name. He lived here and worked at Thiokol for a few years. He's a big fat guy. Made me look like a skinny fellow. And over there on the road, South Cache Junction, she pulled out to pass Brooks Roundy and his pickup going to down to Greenfield, and just as they got to that corner, he turned and put us into the ditch. Broke my left arm in 5 places, between the elbow and the shoulder. Now, let's wait a minute here. And throwed my left hip out. And that's the worst pain I ever had. Now, when we come to rest out there in the bar pit, I couldn't find my left arm. My glasses were off, and so I run my right one down and found my arm wedged in between the seats. The arm was numb, and my hip was just killing me. Oh, that's... And I brought my arm back up in place, and I couldn't move. Reed and Henry Ashcroft were in the car behind us. And he ran over there to see what he could do. And the other carpool went on out to work. It tore the cartilage loose, I believe, in Hugh's knee, bruised up Vera some. But anyway, I believe I was the worst off the bunch. Here was a member of the High Council, just a hurrying around here to run the farm, doing what we could, keeping everybody going. So they went to the phone to call the ambulance. Called back home, told Julia that I was hurt. Her and Glenn came to hospital. Glenn was just old enough that he could get in. And the most welcome sound I ever heard was that siren of that ambulance coming after me. Well, when they started to move me, they said, well, I said, go ahead, get a hold of me. This hurts so bad now, I can't already stand it. And I know you're going to hurt me, just get a hold and let's get her done. They found my glasses and they were kind of scarred up. They went on out, Henry Ashcroft went out and called my boss. Jim Crawford was the department head and Del Davis was the supervisor and said, Lindsay's in a real bad car wreck. And he's on his way to the hospital. Now he's going to be laid up for a while. And they put Reed on sick leave or something to help me. Anyway, so the job was taken care of. And when I got to the hospital, they took me in to put me on the x-ray table. We finally found Dr. Gibbons that morning. And they x-rayed me and said, oh, you're lucky. And I said, I'm glad to know that. They said, your hip, it just throwed out of place. Now, we can put that hip back in. That'll be all right. That arm is another story. So they put me out. When I come to, I was in the hospital room and Dr. Cragen was there. I guess Dr. Gibbons and Dr. Thane and Dr. Claire Payne and Dr. Cragen were the doctors that put me together. They took a big belt and tied me to the table across my stomach and tried to, and then they had two doctors held me on, and I guess I asked Dr. Gibbons later how they did this. He said, it's just like lifting a horse. He said, Dr. Thane and I got a hold of that leg and pulled it out straight. Then lifted it right straight up to where it was right straight up from you and twisted it just at the right amount, and it slipped right back into socket. And I said, we won't really know if it's damaged the nerve, then that socket will die, deteriorate. We won't know for 6 months. I said, all right. When I came to, the leg didn't hurt. They had a pin in my elbow and had my hand tied up in the air. And from this pin, they had a clevis and a nylon rope that run out and over a pulley and down and had 4 pounds of weight on it. That was to pull my arm back in place. Dr. Cragen was there and I said, can I move my leg? And he said, why don't you try? And I moved the leg and felt real good. Didn't hurt. Now he said, keep that leg straight and let those muscles have time to contract back in. You stretch those muscles real hard and they'll draw back into place and you'll be all right. Then I asked about that arm. Well, they didn't tell me all the truth. Years later, I found out that they'd never seen an arm broke that bad it was ever any good. But anyway, I'll get that in later. In fact, I might already have it in this tape somewhere before. But anyway, I couldn't rest. I couldn't sleep. I hurt real bad. They kept coming in and x-raying me in bed. They didn't dare take me out of bed. I was black and blue all across the stomach. Finally, I got my wits about me and I said, "Dr. Gibbons, what are you worrying about?" And he said, "You're bruised so bad in the stomach, across the stomach, that I keep worrying about some internal injuries." And I said, "How did you put my hip in?" And he lifted up that shirt that didn't quite cover the subject and said, "We pulled a big wide belt across here." And I said, "You're right where that black and blue was." "Yes." He said, "That's right. That's where we've bruised you." And he said, "I feel better now. I know what happened." Well, I think it was on Saturday, or was it on, I believe Saturday. This, I think, was about a Thursday, and I hadn't slept. A couple of boys come through administering to the sick, good night. I said, "Would you give me a blessing?" And they done everything but give me a blessing. I laid awake all that night thinking that I wasn't entitled to a blessing because they wouldn't give me one. Peck come along the next night and I said, "Peck, would you administer to me? Peck Hull, I got to have some rest." And he gave me a blessing and gave me some rest. And that night I slept a little. But I believe it was Saturday. President Holt came in to see me. And he said, "Lynn, what can I do for you?" And I said, "My land, come in, give me a blessing." I said, "I asked for a blessing the other night, and a couple of young men came through, and they'd done everything but that. Maybe I'm not entitled to one. But I got to have some rest. Things aren't going very well. I'm not too well. Things aren't coming. They're not coming into place like they ought to." And so he went and got some oil and came back. And by then, Ralph Gleason, whom I worked with, was in there. And he was a high priest. And I said, "Now, President, Ralph here is a high priest. He's qualified to anoint me, but I want you to seal it." He said, "All right. Here's where I learned to administer to the sick." President Holt had the courage of, more courage than most men. And so he went about to give me a blessing. He said the Lord was pleased with my efforts thus far in life, and there was work yet to be for me to do. And he blessed the arm that it would come back into place, that those bones would come in where they ought to. And he blessed that doctor that he'd be alert and attentive and know what he was doing and make the right decision. And he blessed my family that they'd be all right in my absence. So, and he didn't back off like most people do and say, "Now we want the Lord to do it." He was there, and by virtue of the priesthood in the name of Jesus Christ, which he had the right to use, he gave me that blessing. Well, early Sunday morning, Dr. Gibbons come in the room on the run and said, "Lynn, just a little while ago, I reared right straight up in bed. And the impression was so strong on my mind that I had to put 6 pounds on your arm, on that weight, instead of 4. 4 is standard. 4 is normal. But I've never gone again the impressions that have been that strong. So I'm going to put 6 pounds on you. Well, and it pulled that arm back into place. I believe I was about 5 weeks there, tied to that bed. My land, that was a long time. Before they could get the arm solid enough that they could put it into a cast. And then I carried that big old cast. This was when Senator Goldwater was running for president and Lyndon B. Johnson was running for president. The only entertainment I had in that hospital was there was a lady in there that was such a strong Democrat, one of the nurse's aides, that she'd come in that room and I'd call her Mrs. Goldwater. And she'd stand back there and she'd threaten. She said, if you wasn't hurt so bad, I'd whip you. I remember Dr. Cragen came in to see me and he said, Lynn, I've got 2 patients down the hall. I wished I could get them in here to see you. They're not hurt as bad as I am and they're dying. And you're going to live. You're responding to treatment. I told him that maybe I ought to take present hold down to it, give him to administer to him. And I think he lost those patients. I don't suppose they had a blessing like present hold gave to me. He came back and told the High Council that Sunday, as they met, that he'd been in to see me and that I'd be all right. Now that the man up on Mahogany Row out the cycle that I worked for by the name of Max Rubin, I always appreciate him and never met him. But Del Davis and Jim Crawford went down to his office to hunt up what to do about me. I was going to be laid up for quite a while. And Mr. Rubin said, you can count all the sick leave that he's had that he hasn't used the years he's been here. Well, Delmore come in to see me and he said, you haven't used sick leave, you haven't abused it. So I can cover you for 3 months. Without any problem. Then I can do something else for another 3 months. So you're all right for 6 months. Anyway, I still had a week's vacation left. But one day a man showed up, one evening a man showed up in my room. And I didn't recognize him. He told me his name. And he said, I work in Mr. Rubin's office. And Mr. Rubin has said that there will be a layoff while you're here. But you are not. But you're not on the layoff list. In fact, he said, nobody under Jim Crawford is being laid off on this layoff. And I thanked him for the information. Now, he said, you're probably going to hear some bad rumors. Well, little did he know that in the next night or so, Frank Snow called me up and told me that I was being laid off. He thought he was real kind to me to tell me that information. And I said, now, Frank, I know a little more about this than you do, or you think I do, and I'm not being laid off. But I said, you think what you want to. Well, he said, I'm just being kind to you to let you have this information. But anyway, Mr. Rubin didn't want me worrying about it there in that hospital tied to that bed. But it was just an hour or so after this man left that Ruel Lamborn came in. He worked as a supervisor under Jim Crawford. He since left and is here at the down to Utah State College. And I told him what I had just been told. And he said, well, Jim will be glad to know this. But anyway, Mr. Rubin, this man from Mr. Rubin's office said, as soon as you can come to work, we realize your arm will be in a cast and you'll be on limited duty. If they haven't a job in the lab for you that can just fit your situation, Mr. Rubin said he will have a job for you down in his office. Well, when I told Ruel Lamborn that, why, he told Jim Crawford, and Del Davis came back out the next night or so when he come to see me and said they appreciated that information from Mr. Rubin and his office, and that Jim had said, the day you can come to work, you come to work, and he'll have a job that will fit your situation. And I appreciated the kindness of these men. That lessened a lot of the worries that was there. I had no worry there. I believe it was 8 weeks that I was off work. And I returned to work with a great big old cast, that left arm in a great big cast. Now I'm the unit chief in charge of the men under Del Davis. Was Richard Cannon from here in Logan. He lived here in Logan. And I went to see him one day and said, now, Richard, I'd like to come on swing shift. Still tending kids. My wife started teaching school. And he said, fine. Line up your ride. Let's see if this is taken. Line up your ride and come on out to work. Now, you'll have to go to Dr. Loomis. You can stop in his office and bring a thing from your doctor. And as I went in there and laid that cast on and tied up around my neck, and Dr. Loomis wanted to know how I felt, and I told him pretty good under the ordeal. And he said, I'll just ride on here limited duty, and I expect that to be followed. And he said, I'll call Jim Crawford and tell him that. And as I came in the door to there, I met Delmore Davis and Jim Crawford and a few of the others, Larry Morrell, one of the unit chiefs I worked for part of the time, Cannon. Well, Del, he began to say, now, how can you come to work? You don't look. Got that great big old cast on, and Jim Crawford said, for crying out loud, give the man a job he can do and let him go to work. He's been through enough now. Don't be giving him any static. And that's all he was doing, was giving a little static. I generally kept even with those guys on nonsense, and they hadn't seen me for a couple of months, and they was a little bit behind. And I was glad to be back to work. And so as I started to work with an arm and a cast, and Jim Crawford said, now, Lynn, if they give you jobs you can't do, then you let me know and somebody will get their wires straight. I want you to get what rest you need. I want you to sit down. You get tired, you sit down and rest. And I don't want any static out of these guys. So as the word filtered down, but on swing shift, I worked under a man from Texas, Max Anderson. I remember he assigned me to run an aquameter. Now, that's a little moisture machine. Got some of the stinkiness, some pyridine, and some, I can't think of the other stuff right now, that you mix up and you check moisture in most anything, in propellant or any of its component parts. And you kind of have to have things set up, and my golly, it's a job for two hands, and here I was doing it with one hand. He wasn't very considerate. And I worked real hard to do all those things with one hand. I remember one night, none of the solutions were mixed up. And they were gallon jugs that you had to pour out and make your mixes in. And I was doing this with one arm. I went in the storeroom and got my solutions that I needed and my funnels and got some ring stands and some things fixed up there so that I could mix up the solutions. Well, when I started that process, we were in this one hood under back down a little aisle between the benches and the lab. Just over that bench, in the other aisle, Ken Lowry, Chubb as we called him, was titrating. And right behind him was the barrel for the junk. Well, and it was about half full of junk. I started to pour out, but in that meantime, while I had my back turned and the fans are running and the air conditioning and so forth, the janitor, Russ Rogers, come along and dumped the barrel. Max Anderson, in his soft-soled shoes, had crept in the lab and was looking over Ken Lowry's shoulder to see if Ken was titrating right. And I finished this one glass jug and turned around and throwed that right over the bench and into that barrel, which was normal. But the barrel sitting on the cement floor, when that jug come to rest at the bottom and the crash of glass and so forth. Ken Lowry was awful goosey anyway, and so was Max, and Max jumped and goosed Ken, and they pretty near beat one another to death. And Ken, when he come to rest, said to Max, "What are you doing looking over my shoulder?" And then they both stared at me, and I said, "The last time I looked at that barrel, it was half full. I didn't really do that intentionally. Had looks have killed a person, I would have been dead by Max Anderson." But anyway, they got me to doing some work. All the strand burner heads had quit working while I was laid up. That seemed to have been my job for quite a while, and has and still is. Delmore Davis came down there and told Richard Cannon, said, "Don't you assign Lindsay anything else till he fix those strand burner heads. Now, I realize you got one arm, but he can do it with one arm. Take him a little longer, but I want that equipment to work." Well, Max never did believe in anybody working. I mean, fixing anything. All you used to do on his shift was generate data. To fix any equipment so that the data was right didn't mean a thing to him, but he was so scared of his job that all you did was generate data. And so Cannon said in the presence of Max, "Lindsay, you pick you out a good place in there where you can do it and get yourself lined up, and you fix these strand burner heads so they'll work. None of them work right. And here's your charge number. Now you just want nothing else out of you. That's none." Well, I was hurrying my best, doing my best, and trying to get it all done with the right hand with not much use out of that left one. And Max Anderson stood right behind me and just cleared his throat till I was so nervous I could have killed him. I finally said, "Now, Max, you're not doing any good. I'm going as fast as I can." And he said, "Well, I can't grant you that much time." I said, "Then there's no sense starting on this project." "Oh, yes," he said, "that's all you can do." He said, "Why, Del Davis will skin me if you do anything else." But he said, "You've got to hurry." And I said, "I can't do it. I'm doing my best." And he said, "Well, And I said, if you can't go along with this, why then we might as well figure out something else. He said, let me weld some of those wires for you. And so I laid out some stainless steel wires, and we were welding a copper wire on the end so we could silver solder it up at a certain place. I mean, just regular cold solder it. And so we laid out some there for him, and everyone he welded, when it cooled off, just broke in two. Well, I said, you didn't do much good. He was upset at the end of that shift, and so was I. So the next night when I came to work, I went to Dick Cannon, and I said, now, Dick, it's absolutely impossible for me to fix those heads. And he said, why? I said, because Max Anderson stands right over my shoulder and clears his throat until I get so nervous I could kill him, but I'm not able. And he said he will not stand and over your shoulder and clear his throat one more time. And he jumped up and run out of his office. I'm not real sure what he told Max, but Max never stood and looked over my shoulder while I did any of that work again. Now, Max never could understand. He didn't know what was going on. He knew the answers that was supposed to be. But he didn't really understand. You couldn't go to him for help. He didn't know anything. And by golly, but he was just a nuisance. He was a slave driver, and that's all he was. He fit the bill. Slave driver, and that's all he fit. And he was a kind of a pain in the butt. Now, I've worked for lots of people of this caliber. Sometimes you can take a good ordinary common technician or a good workman and promote them to boss, and something turns over in their mind and they're not worth a dime after that. And this often happens. It's real hard sometimes to promote people. I remember a year or so later, you kind of lose track of time, but Jim Crawford, there was a layoff, and Jim told Max, he said, I'll break you back to an A technician, or I'll lay you off as a shift foreman. Well, he said, I'll take the layoff. I don't think he dared, from all the nonsense he'd give us, come back in there as a common man to work with us. Because he wouldn't have known how to run the tests, how to run the equipment, and I don't think he'd have dared to ask after all the nonsense he'd give us.